At the beginning of July, I began to feel the need for a new meeting with the President of the United States, and also for another conference of our joint staffs. We were all delighted when, by a happy inspiration, President Roosevelt suggested that Quebec should be the scene. And when the Governor General and the government of Canada offered us their princely hospitality. Certainly, no more fitting and splendid setting could have been chosen for a meeting of those who guide the war policy of the two great Western democracies at this cardinal moment in the Second World War than we have here. In the plains of Abraham, in the Chateau Frontenac, and the ramparts of the Citadel of Quebec, from the midst of which I speak to you now. Here at the gateway of Canada, in mighty lands which have never known the totalitarian tyrannies of Hitler and Mussolini, the spirit of freedom has found a safe and abiding home. Here, that spirit is no wandering phantom. It is enshrined in parliamentary institutions based on universal suffrage and evolved through the centuries by the English-speaking people. It is inspired by the Magna Carta and the Declaration of Independence. It is guarded by resolute and vigilant millions, never so strong or so well-armed as today. I have also had the advantage of conferring with the Prime Minister of Canada, Mr. Mackenzie King, the experienced statesman who led the Dominion instantly and unitedly into the war, and of sitting on several occasions with his cabinet. And the British and Canadian staffs have been over the whole ground of the war together. The contribution which Canada has made to the combined effort of the British Commonwealth and Empire in these tremendous times has deeply touched the heart of the mother country and of all the other members of our widespread family of states and races. From the darkest days, the Canadian Army, growing stronger year by year, has played an indispensable part in guarding our British homeland from invasion. Now it is fighting with distinction in wider and in widening fields. The Empire Air Training Organization, which has been a wonderful success, has found its seat in Canada and has welcomed the flower of the manhood of Great Britain, of Australia, of New Zealand, to her spacious flying fields and to comradeship with her own gallant sons. All this, of course, was dictated by no law. It came from no treaty or formal obligation. It sprang in perfect freedom from sentiment and tradition, and in a generous resolve to serve the future of mankind. I am glad to pay my tribute on behalf of Britain to the great Dominion and to pay it from Canadian soil. I only wish, indeed, that my other duties, which are exacting, allowed me to travel still farther afield and tell Australians, New Zealanders and South Africans, to their face, how we feel towards them for all they have done and are resolved to do. We have made a 20-year treaty of goodwill and mutual aid with Soviet Russia. You may be sure that we British are resolved to do our utmost to make that good with all our strength and national steadiness. It would not have been suitable for Russia to to be represented at this Anglo-American conference, which, apart from dealing with the immediate operations of our intermingled and interwoven armed forces in the Mediterranean and elsewhere, was largely, if not mainly, concerned with heating and inflaming the war against Japan, with whom the Soviet government have a 5 years treaty of non-aggression. It would have been an embarrassing invitation for us to send. But nothing is nearer to the wishes of President Roosevelt and myself than to have a threefold meeting with Marshal Stalin. If that has not yet taken place, it is certainly not because we have not tried our best or have not been willing to lay aside every impediment and undertake further immense journeys for that purpose. It is because...
Winston Churchill's speech continued.
I have been asked several times since I crossed the Atlantic whether I think the Germans will give in this year or whether they will hold out to another, which will certainly be worse for them. There are those who take an over-sanguine view. Certainly, we see all Europe writhing under Hitler's tyranny. What is now happening in Denmark is only another example. Certainly, we see the Germans hated as no race has ever been hated in human history, or with such good reason. We see them sprawled over a dozen once free and happy countries with their talons making festering wounds, the scars of which will never be effaced. Nazi tyranny and Prussian militarism, those two loathsome dominations, may well foresee and dread their approaching doom. We cannot measure the full force of the blows which the Russian armies are striking and are going to strike. We cannot measure, though we know it is enormous, the havoc wrought in Germany by our bombing, nor the effects upon a population who have lived so long by making wars in the lands of others, and now for the first time for more than a century are having blasting and desolating war brought to their hearths and homes. We cannot yet measure what further results may attend the Anglo-American campaign in the Mediterranean, nor what depression the marked failure for the time being of the U-boat warfare on which German hopes were set, or the consequences of the shattering blows which are being struck may engender in the German mind. We pass here into the sphere of mass psychology, never more potent than in this modern age. Yet I consider that there are dangers in allowing our minds to dwell unduly upon the favorable circumstances which surround us and which are so vividly and punctually brought to our notice every day by press and broadcast. For myself, I regard all such speculations as to when the war will end at this moment as vain and unprofitable. We did not undertake this task because we had carefully counted the cost or measured exactly the duration. We took it on because duty and honor called us to it, and we are content to drive on at it until we have finished the job. If Almighty God in His mercy should lighten or shorten our labors and the torment of mankind, all His servants will be thankful. But the United Nations feel conscious, both as states and as hundreds of millions of individuals, of being called to a high duty, which they will unflinchingly and tirelessly discharge with whatever strength is granted to them, however long the ordeal may last. See how those who stray from the true path are deceived and punished.
Look at this wretched Mussolini and his son-in-law and accomplice, Ciano, on whom the curse of Garibaldi has veritably fallen. I have heard that Ciano, explaining one day why Mussolini had plunged a dagger into the back of falling France and dreamed himself already among the Caesars, said that such a chance would not occur again in 5,000 years. Certainly, in June 1940, the odds and the omens seemed very favorable to fascist ambition and greed. It is not given to the cleverest and the most calculating of mortals to know with certainty what is their interest. Yet it is given to quite a lot of simple folk to know every day what is their duty. That is the path along which the British Commonwealth and Empire, the Great Republic of the United States, the vast union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the indomitable and innumerable people of China, all the United Nations, that is the path along which we shall march till our work is done and we may rest from our labors and the whole world may turn with hope, with science, with good sense, and dear-bought experience from war to lasting peace.